Yeah, so this is actually broadening out from the talk you just heard from Josephine, sort of expanding on the last part of her talk on multi-gene phylogenetics of the microgastroid braconid complex, which includes several subfamilies beyond the microgastrinae. And what I want to do is sort of give you sort of a snapshot of what we're doing at multiple hierarchical levels and a little bit about how effectively our strategy is working at the different hierarchical levels. Okay. All right, so the general outline of the talk is, first I'll introduce the microgastroids a little bit. You just heard a little bit of an introduction to the microgastrinae, which is one of those subfamilies of the microgastroids. And then I'm going to basically talk at those three hierarchical levels: relationships among subfamilies, relationships among genera within the subfamilies, and then relationships among genera within species. So these are actually multiple projects that I'm sort of talking about all in one go here. And while I'm going through this, I want to focus to some extent on the genes used for molecular phylogeny, the effectiveness of the strategy so far, and just give you a little snapshot of the visualization of where the problems lie in our analysis of this group. It's a huge group, both through separate and combined gene analysis. And I'm going to briefly show you at least one example of a filtered supernetwork, which I think is a very useful technique for looking at multi-gene phylogenies like this. And since you're probably saying, filtered what? I thought I would give you a little idea what they're trying to do. I can't really talk in a 10-minute talk too much about what they actually, how they actually work. But basically, they combine the topology and the branch links from multiple genes, the analyses from multiple genes. So you're comparing trees, you're combining the trees together. You can actually simultaneously see the alternative resolutions of the tree, of the taxa, by the different trees if they conflict with one another. And like a super tree, you don't have have to have the same set of taxa in each of the source trees, so you can be missing taxa. So it becomes a super network. That's the super network part. And then there, at a later stage, you can actually filter out splits or relationships among taxa that only occur sporadically among the gene trees. Like, we're mostly interested in finding out what the overall tree is, not what happens to when you get a wacky relationship from one tree or another. You'd actually like to see some of that stuff clean up and disappear. So this is a useful technique, and I'll show you an example a little later. I thought I should mention that before we got to it. Okay, the microgastroid complex of Braconidae has been found to be monophyletic in many studies, both morphological and molecular, for actually several decades. It's the most abundant and diverse group of parasitoids of Lepidoptera, especially the microgastrinae, but some of the other groups are quite diverse as well. And they all carry bracoviruses, a group of symbiotic viruses that they use to suppress the immune systems of their host caterpillars. So they're interesting from a sort of a co-evolutionary point of view as well, and they're only found within the microgastroid complexes. There are comparable viruses also found in ichneumonids as well. There's basically these six subfamilies that are undeniably part of the microgastroid complex. Some of them really huge, like the cardiacolines and the chelonines and microgastrines, and some of them quite small. For instance, coicoiines are only found in a small part of the Cape Province of South Africa. Okay, the genes we've been using for looking among subfamilies here are two mitochondrial DNA genes, the 16S and CO1, which are kind of ubiquitously used in a lot of studies, and five nuclear genes, the 28S ribosomal RNA, and then four protein coding genes, arginine kinase, long-wave rhodopsin, elongation factor 1 alpha, and wingless. We've also got a lot of data for histone H3 as well, but we haven't actually included that in the analyses, in part because there appear to be two copies of this, and we're beginning to get some rather confusing results that we really have to go through and check. RNA polymerase 2 is actually just beginning to be sort of explored in our lab, and we think that one might be a quite promising one as well. So if you actually combine those seven genes that were on the left, the seven on this left side and not the two on the right. In a mixed model Bayesian analysis, one promising aspect is that all the subfamilies come out as monophyletic. And all the red bars here are ones with a posterior probability of greater than 0.95, so they're reasonably well supported. And another part of the tree that's very well resolved is the basal relationship, basal position of chelonines relative to the others. However, these places where the two arrows are places where we really need to know the relationships in order to actually have a subfamily phylogeny for these groups. And they're extremely short branches, and even after seven genes, we really don't have any resolution there. Or actually, not enough support, let's put it that way. So if you take the individual gene trees and look at these, basically almost all the gene trees largely recover the monophyly of each of the subfamilies, which are color-coded here. All the reds are one subfamily and so forth. And however, there's always every gene makes at least some mistakes in terms of placing an outgroup in the middle of one of the in-groups or somehow getting one of the subfamilies to not be monophyletic. They largely agree with one another, but because of these outgroup attachment problems and sometimes the monophyly problems, you end up, when you put these together into a super network at the top, you end up with something that looks like a fisherman's nightmare. And actually, if you look at it really carefully, at the sort of general level, you will see that the different color-coded groups do sort of cluster together, but there's too much uncertainty in terms of the actual relationships that appear over and over again among the groups. If you then start to filter out any relationships that appear among those trees that appear only once in only one gene tree out of the seven, which is the second tree, so you've eliminated anything that only sporadically happens once randomly, then it cleans it up somewhat. And if you change that to two, any particular relationship has to be in at least three of the gene trees to be represented. You get a tree-like diagram with no resolution among the subfamilies. So it basically disappears. And it appears from our divergence time analyses that most of the problems are actually happening in one burst here at the time when the microgastrines and cardiacolines diversified about 50 million years ago, and another case in the subfamilies back here. There appear to be two problems we're having resolving, and they're both problems of short branches deep in the phylogeny. Now, at the generic level, we've done a number of studies at this level, and some of you have seen my talks in ESA before with the comb of death or despair at the base, and we've actually continued to add taxa to this. It turns out that that if you try to figure out which of the genes are actually performing the best, these are actually, each one of these kind of colors is the contribution to that gene to the particular branch. Nothing really stands out as being like a particular culprit. But what really is a culprit is really this diversification among one big section of the genera that's just in extremely short branches, even with seven genes. And we've actually done simulations to show that even with probably 30 to 35,000 base pairs of the same sort, that we would still probably have about four nodes in that phylogeny not resolved. So this seems to be actually the worst problem, is at the generic level, at that 50 million year ago thing. Now, to finish on a somewhat more promising note, at the species level, we've done a number of studies on Cotesia with my postdoc, Alice Michelle Salzat, some of my students, Alejandro Valerio, who you heard about with the platygastroid PBI, Wenyang Choi, and Josephine Rodriguez, who just spoke. We're actually finding that using about four, actually, let me go to the next slide. Actually, about three to four genes often suffices to resolve most of the species relationships, except within species clusters. And Josephine showed you some spectacular cases of where 3 to 4 genes might not be enough in those cases, in these really tight clusters. No individual genes suffices for this, but those same 3 to 4 genes, when you scale them up to the subfamily, to the generic and subfamily level, they're not nearly enough to resolve the relationships. And we're actually have a proposal in at NSF to scale up to about 300 taxa and about 10 genes. So it's a lot of sequencing to resolve a fairly small problem, it seems. So the nuclear protein coding genes seem to be best, and we're actually pursuing more of those at the higher levels. But clearly there's a need for additional slowly evolving nuclear protein coding genes. So if any of you have any bright ideas about ones you think that would work in the 50 million year sort of window, and also at about 70 to 80 million year old window, I would really like to hear that. And the final statement I would like to say is that some families are easier than others. The chelonines are actually relatively easy to resolve at the generic level. The microgastrines are just a total disaster. And it's actually kind of mirrors the problems that microgastrines have had at the morphological level, deciding as what the relationships are as well. There's been a lot of controversies about that as well. So it's not unique to the molecules. So finally, I have a lot of people to thank, not just these, but my students whom I mentioned in the species level work as well. So I'll take some questions if you have any. Thanks. Yes? I didn't have 18S. Oh, you mean 16S? Yeah, no, yes, we did exclude some of the hypervariable regions, yes. That helps some. It's actually, it makes a lot more difference with the 16S than with the 28S in our experience, but yeah. But they're both, yeah, it does help. And in the analyses we've done so far, there were attempts to fit those to secondary structure as well to help in that exclusion process, yes.
Any more questions?